Good morning, everyone. The court calls United States v. Tierman. Counsel for the appellant, please. And in the back, we've been playing around with the hearing system, so if you can't hear, can you stand up and dance or do something to get our attention? Fair enough? Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Captain Michael Berry, and with Captain Paul LeBlanc, I represent the appellant, Lance Corporal Andrew Tierman. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Counsel, could you speak up a little?
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
The lower court's decision should be reversed for 2 reasons. First, the testimony of the hearsay was not harmless because the government argued to the members that the specimen custody document was one of the few important documents that they should focus on in their deliberations. And second, the non-machine-generated data is testimonial because the analysts reasonably believed that their statements would be available for later use at trial. With respect to issue one, the prejudice test for a confrontation clause violation is not whether the evidence at issue did contribute, but simply whether it might have. At appellant's court-martial, Mr. Tito Romero, a chemist with the NDSL, testified against the appellant via Block H. Specifically, he testified in Block H that the lab procedures were properly followed and reported. A different NDSL employee testified in Block G that the appellant tested positive for THC, but neither of them were subject to cross-examination.
Which employee was the one involved with Block G?
There's no name associated with that, Your Honor. So we presume that it may have been Mr. Romero, and may have been
presume
someone
that,
else, but it was
so
not.
Would all 65 have to come in, or how would you do that? What's your argument with respect to Block G?
Simply the person who made that statement would have to come in, Your Honor.
But we don't know who that person is.
It's unclear from the document itself, but it's presumably it was Mr. Romero.
Do we know what that is? Is that a stamp? Is that a typewritten thing? Is that a machine-generated thing?
It appears to be a stamp, Your Honor.
Do we know it, or do we think it?
I don't know with certainty whether it's a stamp or if it was typed in.
And the record doesn't reflect that?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, let's assume that was the only documented issue, that one item. Who's got the responsibility, as a matter of law, on appeal, first at trial, then on appeal, for establishing what it was and who is responsible for identifying who should or should not testify on that?
The government, Your Honor.
Why?
Because when the defense makes the objection, it's the government's responsibility then to demonstrate that there's no reasonable possibility that it contributed to.
I'm not talking about contributing, I'm talking about at trial, you've got a piece of paper with a statement on it. Now, if there's an objection that is hearsay, or alternatively, if there's no objection and we're dealing with the aspect of confrontation that requires the government to prove its case, who's responsible for determining who put that item onto the piece of paper?
It's the government, Your Honor, because they're the ones responsible for proving the elements of the offense. And here, one of the elements is that the appellant, in fact, tested positive or had THC in his system. So that's the most clear and definitive statement within Prosecution Exhibit 4, that he had THC in his system. So they would need to prove that statement is true by bringing in the person who made that statement.
Which test does that Block G record?
There were three tests,
so which test is that one?
Your Honor, that's a summation of the three tests, the initial, the rescreen, and then the GCMS, the confirm, Your Honor. That statement, in essence, encapsulates all three of those into one concise statement.
So it's multiple statements? I don't understand that. So that's actually the testimony of three people?
No, Your Honor. It's a testimony of one person that's saying that after all three tests have been performed, this is the final result. In the manner you're speaking, it functions similarly to the cover memo that this court has previously said is inadmissible, in that it is a concise statement of everything that, of all the tests that have been performed and what the results of those tests were.
How do we know that? How do we know what it stands for?
Because that's precisely what the trial counsel argued to the members.
I understand what the trial counsel argued, but argument is in evidence. How does anyone know what that stands for, that particular entry? Where is there a regulation? Is there a statement otherwise in the document? There are words,
that was
letters. How does anyone know what it stands for, and whose responsibility is it for demonstrating what it stands for?
Your Honor, Ms. Andrea Kaminsky was the expert witness that the government called. And despite the fact that she didn't perform any of the tests here or didn't handle the sample, the trial counsel elicited from her by reading from the documentation package that's what that meant. That stamp meant that the appellant tested positive for THC.
Was that within her area of expertise?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then what's wrong with relying upon it in this case?
Because she did not perform any of the tests or handle any of the samples, Your Honor, so she had no personal knowledge.
She said she was present
for
the confirmation test. Why isn't that adequate for a basis to reach this conclusion?
Because, Your Honor, simply being present is not enough for her to have personal knowledge of the initial test, the rescreen, the chain of custody, or the handling of the sample, Your Honor. So,
well, wait, you know, we're back to the original question. How many people are you going to have to drag in here? If A did chain of custody, or A, B, C, and D did chain of custody, and X did retest, and Y did retest, and Ms. Kaminsky was standing there, are you going to have to bring in 10 people?
Your Honor, the people whose testimony is relevant to those, to chain of custody and to the accuracy of those testing procedures, yes, Your Honor, those people do need to be.
Well, I mean, how many people is that?
In this case, there would be 7, Your Honor.
There would be 7. Okay, you'd have to bring in 7, each for his own piece.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm a little confused as to your response to the Chief Judge's question that the entry on Block G was a aggregation of the three tests. In cross-examination of the witness, she indicated, I believe, that the confirmation test was the only test that indicated the level of THC that was over the cutoff.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that would be the confirmation test would be the test that would be reflected on Block G.
The evidence, the record doesn't demonstrate that, Your Honor. And again, that would be the government's burden to demonstrate that that's all that Block G stated. But looking at Block G in that form, it says THC, and it was when the trial counsel was walking her through this 34-page document that he gets to Block G, and he says, what does that mean? And she says, that means that he tested positive for THC. The fact that she cannot make that statement unless the initial test and the rescreen and the confirm have all been performed properly and reported accurately. She said herself that the DOD standards for this is that they can't use that data unless it's been independently verified from a minimum of 2 separate types of tests.
Now, in making your prejudice argument on page 248 of the record, the expert there testifies from the machine data, it appears, where she says that on page 31, she's referring to page 31, Exhibit 4, that was the test that tested positive for THC. Now, is it your argument that that was an improper testimony, or do we just set that aside because she had earlier referred to the 2624 document?
That, not necessarily, Your Honor. The what makes this a clear case of prejudice is when we look at the Van Arsdale test, it's really the first prong of Van Arsdale, which was the importance of this evidence to the government's case. Here, this matter was placed directly in issue by the defense counsel, and then it was responded to by the trial counsel. So the defense counsel, in its opening and closing statement, argued to the members that this was going to be a case about NDSL procedures and the fact that NDSL is not error-free, that they had recently had a false positive, and that he was not going to have the opportunity, or the members would not have the opportunity to hear any of the analysts who perform this test.
But what weight do we give that testimony where she appeared to testify independently and not from the from the prosecution exhibit?
If this was a case in which that was all she had done, Your Honor, then that would presumably weigh strongly in favor of the government. But in this case, that isn't all that she and the government did.
So that independent testimony isn't enough to cure her earlier reference?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't it cumulative?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
For a couple of reasons. First, it's not cumulative because that the blocking
cumulative, I mean, of the machine-generated stuff.
Well, cumulative with Block G and Block H?
Right.
Right. So Block G and Block H, Your Honor, provide something for the members that her oral testimony alone cannot provide. She testifies over the course of approximately 70 pages about this 34-page document. But the members aren't – that's not what they're – going to rely upon when they go back to deliberate. In fact, the trial counsel published Prosecution Exhibit 4 to the members and then, again, directed their attention to Block G and Block H. So Block G and Block H is the only concise, clear statement that he tested positive.
But, well, that may be, they may be concise and clear, but I don't think you've explained to me why they're not cumulative of the computer-generated data.
Because they provide something for the members that the computer-generated data cannot. It's largely indecipherable lines and graphs.
Well, but we had an expert testifying from it.
It may be cumulative with her testimony, but with the actual graphs themselves, it's not cumulative.
Okay.
So even if it is cumulative, Your Honor, that doesn't mean that there's no possibility that it contributed to the conviction. So even if we excise out Block G and Block H, the burden still rests with the government to show not that that they still could have secured the conviction, but that was it unimportant, or did it not even play a role in the conviction? And that was where the lower court erred in its Van Arsdale analysis, is that it held that...
To be perfectly clear, are you making the statement that any time the form 2624 is entered into evidence, it's going to be harmful, period, per se?
Unless the people who signed that statement are brought...
Period. So it doesn't matter what Kaminsky said in this case, from your standpoint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's no way she could reach an independent judgment and otherwise cure the entry of 2624.
Oh, no, she can reach an independent judgment.
But that's what she did here, and you're saying it's still prejudicial. So my understanding is that you're saying because of 2624's clarity, per se, there's prejudice.
Because she went beyond making an independent judgment, Your Honor. She didn't limit herself, or the trial counsel didn't limit her to simply an opinion. He then published that 2624 to the members and had her read from it as they were looking at it as well.
If he had simply published it and not had her read, would it have been any different?
It possibly could have mitigated some of the harm here, Your Honor, but the fact that they're visually in my mind, I can foresee them walking or turning page by page as he's saying, please turn to page 2 now. What is that document? Please turn to page 3. What is that document? She says this is the specimen custody form. Okay, Block G, what does that mean? He tested positive for THC.
Well, but that wasn't my question. My question is following up on the chief judge, if it comes in, but she doesn't refer to it in her testimony, is it still per se prejudicial?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, because, again, Mr. Romero...
Well, you say per se, and then you say in this case. Which is it? Can it come in without the person who prepared it coming in?
No, Your Honor.
Ever?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay. That's where that's your contention. Thank you.
Counsel, in response to the questions that I asked and Judge Erdman asked, I've got two separate pictures of those blocks and how they were used in this case. One is that she simply read the entry on the block. And the second is that she explained what the blocks meant. In response to my question, you said that it, she explained that it meant he was positive on all three tests. And in response to Judge Erdman's question, you said it meant that he was positive on at least two. So let's focus specifically on her testimony. What did she say about the meaning of those blocks other than to simply reiterate what the blocks said?
She did not explain the blocks, Your Honor, and she didn't say this is what block G means. She simply read the result in court. It was later on in her testimony, as she's going through the individual tests that have to be performed in order to arrive at the conclusion that block G makes.
Did she say that? Did she say that these tests will then be reflected in block G? You know, what I'm trying to get at is, are we looking only at her articulation of what's in block G, or are the members at some point told something about those two blocks that would enhance their understanding of what those words meant?
No, the record does not reflect that she made any such explanation later on, no.
So, based on the record, we have no idea what block G and what block H meant other than the words themselves. That is, we don't know whether they're based on one, two, or three tests. Is that your answer? Is that a different? I'm not trying to trap you here. I'm trying to clarify the dialogue that we had with myself and Judge Erdman about what block G and block H stand for. I'm not asking you to testify. I'm not asking you about your general knowledge. What does the record in this case say about what G and block H meant beyond the words on the face of those blocks?
Your Honor, the only words that she stated with respect to block G, so block G in and of itself is just three letters, THC.
Right.
Her testimony with respect to block G is it tested positive for THC, it being the appellant's sample.
So we don't know which of the three tests that resulted in that or anything from the record.
Not from the record.
Okay, thank you.
Her explanation is correct, Your Honor.
Well, if she simply said it tested positive for THC and it says THC, that's simply reading it, right? That's not explaining it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to issue two, this the non-machine generated documents, this court should hold that they are testimonial. This court identified three classes of testimonial statements: affidavits, formalized statements, and statements whose primary purpose is to preserve evidence. The non-machine generated documents, so the internal review documents and the chain of custody documents, fall within the second and third classes.
So you would apply a primary purpose test?
Yes, sir. Yes,
Your Honor. Is it your view that the correct statement of the law after Crawford and the 300 cases that followed Crawford is you look for the primary purpose?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How if at all, does Williamsville v. Illinois cut here?
It does not, Your Honor.
How so? I mean it seems like, you know, Mr. Justice Thomas is insisting on indicia of formality here, in these cases, and this stuff certainly does not seem to have indicia of formality in the sense Mr. Justice Thomas is talking about it. So where are we with respect to Supreme Court jurisprudence in this area?
Your Honor, Mr. Justice Thomas's opinion in Williams, or Williams itself, simply stands for the proposition that Williams loses in that case, and that the Supreme Court of Illinois.
So you're saying the thing has no precedential effect?
That's correct, Your Honor, because the nowhere in Williams is the primary purpose test overruled or invalidated or anything, and in fact, I would argue it is buttressed by Williams, that it continues to be the valid and acceptable test for determining whether a statement is testimonial. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor, if I can.
Other questions up here?
What is the primary purpose of chain of custody documents?
It is to preserve to document an unbroken chain of custody. So
the main thing that is intended to be proven in a case like this is that the specimen, whatever it may be, contains drugs. That's what the case is all about. And so this seems to be a corollary or something different than the main purpose that the prosecution is trying to do to prove the case.
It's It is a corollary, Your Honor, but it is equally, or maybe not quite equally, but it is also vitally important for the government because the military judge instructed the members in this case that in order to convict, they had to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of the lab procedures and handling of the sample. So there, it became an issue that the members had to find beyond a reasonable doubt. To conclude, the members had to be convinced that appellant had THC in his system and that the tests used to determine that THC were accurate. To do this, the trial counsel focused their attention on the evidence that he needed to secure the conviction, Bloch GNH. The members relied upon those blocks, and they also relied upon the chain of custody and internal review documents in voting to convict the appellant. For those reasons, this court should reverse the decision of the lower court.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Major William Kirby, and I, along with Mr. Brian Keller, represent the United States. I'm going to discuss two things, Your Honor. First, the inclusion of blocks G and H were harmless beyond reasonable doubt because these statements were unimportant to and wholly cumulative with the government's case. Second, the internal review and chain of custody documents, notes, stamps, and dates lack sufficient formality and purpose to be testimonial statements. Regarding AOA 1, first and foremost, Ms. Kaminsky was present for the confirmation test. Her testimony both corroborates the accuracy of the GCMS test, and her testimony also opens up the availability for cross-examination regarding the reliability and accuracy of these tests.
What's the government's position as to what the entry THC and block G means? What does that reflect?
Your Honor, the question was asked, what was the result of any test? And Ms. Kaminsky responded, it was positive for THC. The question was, what was the result of any test? She was present for the third test, which is the confirmation test.
But what does that THC represent? Does that represent the results from the confirmatory test? Does that represent some collective statement about all three tests?
Your Honor, the procedures of the lab are that you do not have a positive test until you have a gold standard, you have the GCMS positive result, which is in this case 37.17 nanograms of THC per milliliter. So the government, or the position I believe is that Ms. Kaminsky was testifying regarding specifically the results of the confirmation.
So whose testimony, if it is testimony at all, whose testimony would that THC statement be, if it is a statement at all?
Your Honor, it could be Ms. Kaminsky's. Good point.
Does the government have a position on this?
Well, Your Honor, regarding stamps, notes, signatures, without a formal attestation, the formality is only that should occur, that should be attended. The government offers that is not an actual statement. But Ms. Kaminsky does testify regarding the THC, and she testifies that, in accordance with her experience with the third test, that in fact, sample tested positive for THC.
Is it enough that she was in the room, or does she have to be the hands-on technician?
Your Honor, it's enough that she's in the room because she can testify from first-hand knowledge what the result of that test
What the result was.
Counsel, to get back to Chief Judge's question, what does the record show as to the meaning of those two blocks? What was it derived from? I'm not asking for your speculation or your testimony about what the normal procedure of lab is. What does the record show?
Regarding the block that stamps THC, Your Honor, it merely shows a stamp stating THC.
Someone stamped that. So we got a mystery witness in the case.
That mystery witness, yes.
Okay, thank you.
However, again, Your Honor, the record does show when the question was asked regarding that, Ms. Kaminsky testified that the sample tested positive. Doesn't show that she stamped that record, Your Honor, but it does show that she was testifying regarding to her personal experience whether or not that sample tested positive.
She was referring to that particular block, or was she referring to her own analysis of the numerical data otherwise available?
Your Honor, she's referring to her own personal knowledge, her personal experience that the sample tested positive.
Well, wait a minute. During direct examination, when she is walking through the document and he asks her what that document reflects, she says that indicates that he was positive. There, she is not going to the underlying machine documents. It seems to me that she's reflecting what that document said.
Yes, Your Honor. It's absolutely correct. But that also goes to the fact that this stamp is wholly cumulative and unimportant to the government's case.
Counsel, let's get back to the underlying question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does her testimony do anything more than have her read that notation? That is, at what point does she say, based on my expertise, my knowledge of the lab, that stamp means that he's positive?
Your Honor, her testimony does not go as far as you just noted.
So all we know is that she read hearsay at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But that statement, Your Honor, is wholly cumulative and unimportant to that stamp is wholly unimportant and cumulative with the government's case, as the record reflects, as she goes throughout her cross-examination.
Well, it might be cumulative, but you can't say it's unimportant, because that's the crucial issue in the case.
Your Honor, the weight of that statement is unimportant to the government's case, because Ms. Kaminsky actually testified regarding the computer-generated data.
Well, so that makes it cumulative, but that doesn't make it unimportant.
Yes, Your Honor, it makes it cumulative. What she does is she testifies regarding her own personal experience, what she saw occur with the GCMS process. She also, Your Honor, relies on the test, the computer-generated testing. And in that test, within those test results, it shows that the autopsy was functioning properly, two, the calibration parameters were correct, and three, the analyzer code worksheet showed no error in the testing. Under Regulation 2, this court held that machine-generated data is still admissible, and she properly relied on both her personal experience with the GCMS testing to show that the sample tested positive, and she also relied upon the computer-generated data. In addition to that, Your Honor, she testified regarding the procedures in terms of the lab, that the lab is consistently tested or inspected both by external agencies and internally. She's been a member or an employee of the lab since September 2008. So both on her personal knowledge of the lab's procedures, her personal knowledge of the actual test, and also based on the computer-generated data, which this court has said is admissible, the government's case was very strong. Contrary to what the defense says, that we have a weak urinalysis, a naked near urinalysis, the government, or I offer that again, the fact that she actually saw the test, the fact that computer-generated data regurgitates actual safety protocol to show that the machine was actually operating within manufacturer specifications, and then also that she can testify regarding the lab's procedures, show that the government has an extremely strong case, and the mere mention of her reading that stamp at the beginning of her direct examination is wholly cumulative.
We asked the appellant whether it was per se prejudiced ever to put in the 2624. And I'm not asking that. Your question is, are you advancing the Kaminsky test? And that is, so long as you have someone named Kaminsky come in who can testify to the charts and all that stuff and is an expert in urine, it doesn't really matter what's put before the members.
No, Your Honor.
So, I mean, the Crawford line of cases can essentially be farmed for any quote you want from it. And so the question is, going forward, is it good enough to always have Kaminsky testify?
Your Honor.
From the government standpoint, it seemed to be that's the result, which is because it's cumulative. And if someone comes in and says all the things that Kaminsky said, does that cure all future Crawford problems, if any?
Your Honor, of course, if someone comes in with the identical knowledge that Ms. Kaminsky had, and the facts are that a 2624 was submitted into evidence, then yes, Your Honor, then if the facts are the same, then going forward, yes, her testimony does cure the cumulative issue. Her testimony on her Van Arsdale analysis shows that her testimony combined with computer-generated data shows that the mere submission of that stamp on the 2624 was cumulative, Your Honor. So yes, if the facts in this case are repeated and going forward, then yes.
Well, It may be, you know, it may be cumulative, but what about the appellant's argument that its appearance of officiality, its appearance of finality, THC, you know, would of necessity have some effect on the members?
No, Your Honor. No.
Why not?
Again, the court should use a Van Arsdell analysis to determine whether or not...
Well, that's what they're saying. They're saying this is Van Arsdell 1, and you know, here it is screaming, you know, he used drugs.
No, Your Honor. Again, you should look at the record in totality. You should mm-hmm. look at the entire strength of the government's case, the entire record. You should look at the opportunity of the admissible evidence to corroborate the inadmissible statements on material points, which the admissible evidence does in this case, the availability of cross-examination. Ms. Kaminsky was present for the test, so the defense had the opportunity to cross-examine her. However, it did not, because it chose to go with the defense of the suggestion.
Counsel, the fact that she was present at the test doesn't help you with the Confrontation Clause issue, okay? I mean, if in fact it's a testimonial statement, for being present at the test doesn't help you, okay? I think that what you're missing is the questions that you've been asked about the THC annotation of the document is whether it was important or unimportant to the case. Okay? And I think that people have been asking you to explain why it is or is not important in light of the fact that it's stamped on an official document signed and certified by an individual. So that's a different question than whether it's cumulative or whether it's repeated elsewhere in her testimony. So can you answer that question?
Ma'am, are you asking if that stamp is testimonial? Is that what you're
asking? No, I'm asking you to explain how it is or is not important, how it is important or unimportant to the government's case.
Respond to the appellant's argument that notwithstanding all the testimony from Kaminsky, the members still had the option of looking at 70 pages of Kaminsky graphs or one simple statement on a document that says THC. And why wouldn't a member gravitate toward the keep it simple principle and say, why do we need to go through 70 pages of testimony when we can simply read three initials?
Your Honor, because
is that a fair summary of your question?
Because they didn't have to go through 70 pages of computer-generated data. They had an expert witness who testified three times throughout the trial in reading that computer-generated data where she said that he tested positive for the screening.
But no one is discounting any of that, okay? And no one's discounting the fact that this information was repeated in different ways in the course of the trial. That goes to the cumulative point.
Yes, ma'am.
The question that we, I think, are collectively asking you is, assuming that the stamp that Box D and H together constitutes a testimonial statement, and that is one of the questions before us, assuming that that's the case, you know, why is it unimportant to the government's case? How is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? I mean, how can we know that it didn't contribute to the verdict when it's the simplest place for them to look, which is a different question than whether it was available in other places?
Ma'am, because the record is, again, because there is nothing in the record that shows that they went to the simplest place. And this court can actually look and look at the gravity of the weight of the evidence, the bulk of the evidence that is presented by the government. I understand that you're saying, how can we say it's unimportant? It's unimportant because that document did not need to be...
But it was introduced. And yes, it had an official government form that had this stamped on it. And your argument is basically saying it didn't matter whether they saw that or not.
Yes, sir. Also, the government offers that it applies the Van Arsdell analysis to determine whether or not that error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And in applying that analysis, we go through the five factors that are in the Van Arsdell analysis, and we weigh each of those factors. And after weighing each of those factors, as we did in our brief, you can see that after a Van Arsdell analysis, that in fact, that stamp and that signature on the 2624 was unimportant to the government's case. It was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So we have to go through that analysis to come to that conclusion.
And why was it unimportant? I still haven't figured that out.
It is unimportant, Your Honor, in essence, because we can look to the Van Arsenal analysis of 4 or 5 factors to show that, A, it was cumulative, B, that we...
Okay, well, cumulative is different than unimportant.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's additional factors in the Van Arsenal analysis.
Why don't you ask it this way? Why would a member gravitate towards Kaminsky's testimony if you were a member? I suppose this, I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but is a member more likely to pay attention to the expert testimony or to the pile of papers? And if so, why in each case?
Mr. Honor, a member is more likely to listen to a live, in-person expert testimony regarding graphs that are put in front of them. And in this case, Ms. Kaminsky took a red pen and circled on several occasions the DOD, the sample test above the DOD cutoff. It's a live, in-person expert testimony. She stood in front of the members and she gave her credentials. And there's weight being given to Ms. Kaminsky's ability as an expert. She was sworn, or she was accepted as an expert. And she testified regarding these documents, live, in-person from the members. That is why the mere stamp on a document is unimportant to the government's case, because it's outweighed by the fact that we have an expert who is live in person testifying regarding the actual computer.
You've got an expert. She's testifying at length. But you've also got this stamp here, this thing here that's laying there in evidence. Doesn't that at the very least bolster the expert? And in that case, how can it be HBRD?
No, Your Honor, because that stamp, the stamp actually sits alone. I apologize, Your Honor. The stamp sits alone. It's as small as just a stamp. It is not a sworn to. It is not. It lacks the intended formalities.
Okay. Now we're getting to Mr. Justice Thomas. It lacks the indicia of formality.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not a limiting formality that is should be attended with.
Well, then that leads to how does Williams affect this case? The same question I asked the other side.
Well, Your Honor, first...
What's Williams stand for? Is it totally non-presidential, as the appellant seems to be saying? Does it affect this case at all?
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
How so?
It affects this case because in the concurrent opinion from Justice Thomas, Justice Thomas says that you need to have the solemnity and the formality that's attended in the court testimonial documents of an affidavit, a deposition, prior testimony, or a confession. And none of those attendant formalities are present with that stamp of THC.
But what is the purpose of the certification on 2624?
Your Honor,
it certifies that entry was correct.
Yes, sir. It does.
What's the purpose for that if it's unimportant? The government is going to the trouble of certifying it.
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry, Your Honor, what was the last part?
The government's going to the trouble of certifying it.
It has, Your Honor.
And so, I guess, why is it unimportant if the government feels it's important enough to certify it?
Your Honor, yes, the government did certify 2624. However, again, the government goes back to, has to look to the Van Arsenal analysis and determine whether or not that document and that certification from the G&H are actually harmless beyond reasonable doubt. It actually points to, again, Your Honor, the Van Arsenal analysis determines whether it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt. And Your Honor, the government offers that stamp. But that piece of evidence is unimportant because, again, if the government thought that evidence was as important as this court may be placing or offering that it is, then perhaps the government would have just offered that 2624 and no other testimony and no other computer-generated data.
Are you asking us to overrule Sweeney? I mean, we already dealt with this issue with respect to the 2624 and Sweeney.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, are you asking us to overrule that case?
No, absolutely not. What this court says is that the 2624 was an error to have that submitted. That statements in G&H were testimonial. However, it reserved its judgment on whether or not that statement was harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
At different times it seemed that you've been arguing that Block G is not testimonial, or that the document itself is not testimonial, or that you want to parse out little pieces of it. So I'm just trying to clarify that point.
No, ma'am. That document is testimonial. However, again, this court directed the lower courts to do a financial analysis and determine whether or not that evidence was harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
Turning to the chain of custody document, can you, you may not be able to, but can you do, what does footnote one in Melendez-Diaz mean?
Yes, ma'am, footnote one in Melendez-Diaz.
I mean, that's a real question. I mean, do you have a view as to what it means?
Yes, ma'am, I think it's very important because it's pointing out that in a chain of custody, a document, if there is actual testimonial evidence that's being submitted within those chain of custody documents, then that testimonial evidence needs to be submitted live. However, what's key is that there's a distinction that's offered there. If all signatures and all stamps and all dates that are included in a chain of custody document, as the defense posits, are actually testimonial, then there would be no need for that distinction. The point is that there is a distinction. The testimonial evidence that would be submitted would be a statement, a sworn to, a statement that actually has the intended formalities that Clarence Thomas talks about.
Well, Justice Thomas's separate opinion is not the opinion of the court. I mean, I understand that he's deciding vote to get to five, but it's not the opinion of the court. I guess what I'm asking a different way, footnote one doesn't tell us whether a chain of custody document is or is not testimonial, does it?
It does not. It does not. But
so would it be a different case? Would it, and you say it's that this chain of custody document is not testimony, would it be a different case if a particular signature or part of the chain of custody document had been challenged in particularity by the accused?
Yes, ma'am, because, well, it's my understanding that the defense objected to the lab documents in total. So, assuming they actually objected to actually the chain of custody documents as well.
No, I'm not saying a general objection. I'm saying they said this signature here, we don't think that person really signed it, or we don't think that this is what actually happened to this urine sample.
Yes, ma'am. That would come under your footnote 15 in Sweeney, because then you would actually have more evidence fleshed out on the record. And this case does not have such evidence fleshed out on the record. You said specifically that more evidence that could tip the balance the other way. In this case, when we talk about the chain of custody documents, what we have are just stamps, dates, and signatures. Nothing more. And when we look to go further, ma'am, with the internal review documents, there are no actual statements on those internal review documents that actually say the presence of THC. What we have are just, again, signatures, stamps, and dates. There is nothing within those documents, ma'am, that shows the salinity. And I recognize that we're talking about the formalities that are attended. There are no written down facts.
Well, you don't, may I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
You don't disagree that the chain of custody document that exists that we're looking at here in this case is basically shorthand, right, for a great deal of evidence that would otherwise have to be provided by the government. Do you understand what I'm saying? You're submitting that in lieu of calling all those people that handled the evidence, which needs to be in an unbroken chain of evidence, right, in order for the accused to be convicted.
Absolutely, ma'am, which is properly governed by the military rules of evidence. What the Confrontation Clause addresses are when we have testimonial statements. When we actually have a testimonial statement, then the Confrontation Clause ensures that testimonial statement should be subject to cross-examination. In this case, if those records, which, as we just said, have notes or shorthand, constitute a business record exception under the hearsay rules, then it comes in. What the Confrontation Clause protects against is if we actually have a testimonial statement that is being entered. In this case, we do not have testimonial statements being offered because they lack the attendant formalities, and their primary purpose is not to prove the guilt of the appellant. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. Is there any further question?
May I have a follow-up question?
Sure.
On chain of custody? Let's assume that the accused was charged with possession, and the evidence of possession was that a police officer picked up a bag of leafy substance from the accused, then sent it to the lab, and it was tested. The government stands up at the beginning of its case, and it introduces a document that's the chain of custody document as to the leafy substance. And that's all they introduce. The defense says there's no evidence in this case that the leafy substance is connected with my client other than this document. Where's the live witness? What happens in that case?
Well, Your Honor, historically, chain of custody documents come into evidence because their primary purpose is not to prove the guilt of the appellant, but to account for property.
But it's doing that in order to, what, prove the guilt, right? In lieu of having to bring in all the witnesses.
Yes, Your Honor, but as Judge Erdman pointed out, that's a corollary. Its primary purpose is to account for property. It's not to account for or not to prove the guilt or the past criminal conduct.
But if the only document in the case that connects the substance with the accused is that chain of custody document, how do you prove possession? If the police officer doesn't testify in the case, how do you prove that substance that was tested was in the possession of the accused?
Well, Your Honor, there's two pieces to that. We have to get the evidence from the accused to the chain of custody, the person who actually signed.
Okay. And so you need a live witness to do that, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where's the live witness in this case? Who in this case testified that this particular substance was taken from the accused?
Your Honor, that would be the person who administered the drug exam or the urinalysis at the command, and they testified that that in fact was.
And so that evidence is in this case?
That is, Your Honor. And in addition to that, when the evidence is received by the drug lab, the person who can testify and lay the proper foundation for that chain of custody document is Ms. Kaminsky. And because she actually has the knowledge to say that the document is what it purports to be. And that's the foundational question, again, Your Honor, which is...
And is that the basis, then, for your response to Judge Erdman, that we're just dealing with a corollary here rather than with the primary evidence connecting the substance to the accused?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
No further questions, Your Honor. That concludes my argument.
Thank you very much. Appellant. You get bonus time, but do not feel obliged to take it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But deal with as many questions as you get and so on.
Your Honor, the government's making contrary arguments from trial to now on appeal. At trial, the government made Block's GNH important to its case. The trial counsel directed the member's attention specifically to that page, page 3 of Prosecution Exhibit 4, not to Ms. Kaminsky's testimony. He did not argue to the members that they should look to Ms. Kaminsky's testimony. He argued, turn to page 3 of Prosecution Exhibit 4. That's one of the few important pages in this document. The defense counsel also made it important because he objected that he did not have the opportunity to cross-examine any of the witnesses who performed the tests. The government has also argued that it's simply enough that Ms. Kaminsky was present or in the room when the testing or when the GCMS occurred. We don't get to the GCMS test unless it already tested positive on initial test 1 and the rescreen. And there was nobody who performed the initial test 1 or the rescreen that was brought live to testify with the opportunity for cross-examination.
Counsel, could you address that last question that I asked the government in this case, and that is, who identified the substance that was tested as belonging to the accused? The government has said that we had the witness from the unit testify. What more is needed to establish the chain of custody for purposes of confrontation as opposed to the evidentiary issues dealing with chain of custody?
Your Honor, the urinalysis observer was simply the first link in the chain of custody. We would also need the rest of the links until we get to the point at which the testing is complete.
Well, is that what Melendez Diaz? We may not know comprehensively what footnote 1 in Melendez Diaz means, but does Melendez Diaz mean that if you have the first person testify live, you have to have everybody else, or is it suggesting there will be cases in which that's not the case once you have the one live witness?
Your Honor, that footnote implied, the Supreme Court implied, that if there is an objection, which there was in this case, then anyone whose testimony is relevant to chain of custody. So it may be, there may be a stipulation as to, okay, the defense doesn't require this person and this person, but what about who is this person right here on this who signed the chain of custody?
Can you point us to any place in the record where the defense counsel at trial objected to the failure to produce a particular person or challenged a particular step in the chain of custody after the unit person, the individual from the unit testified?
Your Honor, they certainly didn't do it by name in terms of, okay, where is Ms. Folster or Mr. Hoffenbarger or any of these people. But what they did was they said, we can't make that we can't object on those grounds because we haven't had the opportunity to ask those people those questions. The government's never produced them. So how do we even know if there was an unbroken chain of custody?
So your answer to my question is no, we didn't object on those.
That's correct. No, there was not an objection on those grounds. With respect to the government's argument that the non-testimony or non-machine-generated data is not testimonial, there are indicia of formality within those documents, Your Honor. They can be characterized as formal because they are found on OPNAV official Navy forms with signatures that attest to specific things. The declarants who make those statements by signing their signature on this form can be held accountable and face disciplinary action if their statements are false. That's an indicia of formality. And then on page 2 of Prosecution Exhibit 4, there's a line through with an initial correcting mistakes that are on that form. That's the type of thing that we do with formal documents. If it was informal, there would be no reason to do that. And even if this court finds that they don't have the indicia of formality, they certainly satisfy the primary purpose test. The mission of the Navy Drug Screening Lab, as Ms. Kaminsky testified, is to support the command in deterring illegal drug use by providing legally defensible drug testing. To this end, she testified that she has a master's degree in forensic science and law, and that she regularly undergoes annual recertification as an expert witness. That means that the documents that lab produces, the analysts who produce those documents and the people who certify as the initial certifying official and the final certifying official, they must reasonably understand themselves to be assisting in preserving those statements for later use at trial. Therefore, it satisfies the primary purpose test. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we stand in recess until 10:30. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess until 10:30.